Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the New Books in African American Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Omari Averett Phillips, the host of the channel. Today we'll be talking to Dr. Melissa Ford about her new book, A Brick in the Bible, Black Women's Radical Activism in the Midwest During the Great Depression. Dr. Melissa Ford, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm so happy to be here.
Wonderful, and we're happy to have you here. So I wonder if you could just talk a little bit about yourself, just sort of introduce us to you.
We're going to be talking a lot about the Midwest today, so I got to come out and say I am a native Midwesterner. I'm from St. Louis, Missouri. I went to college in Wellesley College. I basically tried to get as far away from the Midwest as possible, and we'll come back to why that matters, and then returned to St. Louis for my PhD in American Studies from St. Louis University. I now teach African American history at Slippery Rock University, which is about an hour north of Pittsburgh, so still in the Midwestern area. I'm just so thrilled to see this project come to completion. It was my PhD dissertation and a long labor, let's just say that. So that's a little bit about me. Excited to talk more about the implications of all my background for this project.
Wonderful, wonderful. And I wonder if you could tell us how you sort of came to this project.
Right. And so that's where it is. Like, I was a native Midwesterner. I was born in Missouri. I was born in St. Louis. And I kind of thought I knew the history. But the thing was, I was a white woman born in the suburbs of St. Louis. And the histories of Missouri and the area and the region we learned were very reflective of the mainstream stereotypes. It's a prairie. It's this conservative, it's flyover land. It's the American heartland. It's where the democratic values of our nation are. And if we learned anything about local history, it was Lewis and Clark, or maybe it would be the Gateway to the West and the St. Louis Arch, maybe if we got to the 20th century. And I realized as I went down my further studies in my PhD program that there's this history that is very much intentionally marginalized, and that of the history of the Black working class in St. Louis, and then, of course, the rest of the Midwest. And so I really do have to give a shout out to Dr. Heidi Artizone at St. Louis University, who offered this class called Mini Midwest, Race and Citizenship in the Midwest. And I was like, oh, the Midwest, I'm a Midwesterner, I can take this no problem, because I really didn't have a huge interest in the Midwest. But then once we started and learning this tragic, violent, but beautiful and inspiring story of people of color, and specifically African Americans in the Midwest, I began to say, well, there's something here that, you know, white girls from the suburbs of St. Louis need to know. And so from there, the project kind of took off. It's started with kind of looking at the working class and what they're doing during the Great Depression, then realizing things are happening in Chicago and Detroit and Cleveland at the exact same time. And there are parallels that we can draw, there are similarities we can draw, but there are also distinctions and particularities that really make this period so alive and worthy of study. And it's worthy of study whether I say so or not, just because it is.
And so in your introduction to this work, you talk about sort of Midwestern Black radicalism. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that and how it relates to the Black radical tradition. and then also sort of how it relates to the larger project that you have here.
Yeah, so I mean, you can't say the Black radical tradition without saying Cedric Robinson. He like wrote the book, Black Marxism and the Making of a Black Radical Tradition, and it opened up this immense floodgates of scholarship on people of African descent and Marxist radical ideologies and practices throughout the course of world history. And so, using Robinson kind of as an inspiration, I decided when and where does my place as a historian come to amplify these stories of particular characters. And for this, I kind of go back to this phrase that Robin Kelly just gave in a conference 2 years ago, saying that, you know, Cedric Robinson went beyond Marx. He went beyond Marx and looking at race. But we, as historians of today, scholars of today, academics and activists of today, have to go beyond Robinson. And so when we go beyond Robinson, we're looking at local regions, we're looking at women, we're looking at these marginalized communities and these stories that have been erased, essentially. Well, not completely. And so my goal as a historian is to amplify those stories. So Midwestern Black radicalism, going back to that, I have to admit, I was a grad student when I thought of that term, and I was like, oh my God, did I just make up a new term? And I Googled it, and I did. And I was like, I need to patent this now. I need to get my trademark. And you know, as a grad student, how exciting it is when you can contribute something brand new. But then I had to define it. And that's where the problem came in. But if we look at Cedric Robinson and seeing how we can not necessarily isolate, but insert ourselves in this particular historical context of the Midwest in the Great Depression, we can see then how things like patterns of migration, light and heavy industry, domestic work for Black women, de facto segregation, poor relief and welfare for families, all kind of culminate into this very specific moment of social unrest. And that's unrest that is involved, identified by the actions of these Black women. Because I say that Black Midwestern radicalism is the core of it, is these Black women's stories. So we're taking this tradition of Black radicalism, we're taking Cedric Robinson and just pushing it to the next level. And I say we, because I'm not the only one doing this. As much as I want to tout to that I made up this term, Western Black Radicalism, there are so many other scholars who are currently with this project. Maybe not on the Midwest, but definitely looking at how Black women were carriers of the Black radical tradition, are carriers of the Black radical tradition, and need to be amplified more in our nation's history.
And you also use the concept of sort of community feminism throughout much of this work. I wonder if you could talk just a little bit about that as well.
Yeah, so that idea comes from Eula Taylor, who I think that was her big term that she came up with. And she was specifically talking about the UNI, the Universal Negro Improvement Association in Detroit, and how African-American women kind of negotiated their position. Because UNI, obviously a Black nationalist organization, a lot of masculine imagery and ideology. And Eula Taylor basically makes this argument that this wasn't all that was happening. Black women in this organization were finding a place for themselves. They're challenging those ideas of masculinity and racial hierarchy. They are exhibiting certain traits of feminism that today we recognize as feminism, but they absolutely didn't back then. And Keisha Blaine also kind of draws on that, saying like these women in the UNIA were using proto-feminist ideas because at no point were they just giving up and rolling over to the patriarchy, to white-dominated society, to capitalist oppression. They were negotiating and finding their own voices and what their roles would be in that.
And you just spoke about sort of the Universal Negro Improvement Association. That plays a large role, I think, in each one of these studies. I wonder if you could just give us just a little bit about how that actually sort of primed the pump for radical organizing in a lot of these different areas.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great way to put it. It primed the conditions. And for this, I got to give a shout out to Eric McDuffie, who's currently doing work on the Black Midwest and UNIA. And so I did draw from some of his work, but I'm not the first historian to kind of say that the UNIA has primed the stage or whatever, set the stage for further Black radicalizing organization. But to say that, you know, it happened in Detroit, St. Louis, Cleveland, and Chicago in very similar ways shows that these cities were all operating with similar tendencies, right? The fact that there's de facto segregation, the fact that unemployment of Black workers is twice that of white workers, the fact that Black women have very little voice. So the UNIA sought to address those issues in its particular Black nationalist form. But when Garvey's deported and the organization doesn't die, it undergoes a transformation, and that transformation loses members. It's a very particular point in world history. It's the end of the Roaring Twenties, right? It's the end of the 20s, and it's the world's greatest economic depression. And so when Garvey isn't there, when Garveyism isn't there to answer those questions of the Black working class, this is where the Communist Party sweeps in. And really, the Communist Party has been training for this since their beginning, right? They're waiting for capitalism to fail and come in with communism as the answer to working class's woes. But I mean, more recently in 1929, the Communist Party is saying, has entered what they call the third period, where they're looking to extend communism and radical unions to Black workers and Black women specifically. So when we talk about the UNIA's importance, of course it's important for the amazing work it did in the 1920s, but that groundwork it laid for Black workers to think about, hey, maybe white-dominated society doesn't have the answers. Maybe the Communist Party, who is now looking to organize Black workers, looking to organize Black women, maybe they have those answers. And we can really see that played out on the ground level. Chicago especially, it was a hotbed of UNIA activity. So when the UNIA kind of faded in its influence, those individuals picked right back up with the Communist Party. There are several women in particular who were like, you know, I was looking for something to do. Not like in those terms, but like, I'm looking for a place to fight. The Communist Party came in and helped us organize. They gave us those that platform. They gave us opportunities to learn. And that's not unique in Chicago, but it's a very important moment of transition for Black radical tradition.
And so the first study that you have in this book is in Detroit. And I wonder if you could speak a little bit about the Black women that are organizers in Detroit that you sort of highlight in chapter one.
Right. And I think, honestly, the best way to do that is just to tell you about some of these individual women, give them names, because honestly, I love doing that. I'm a historian because I love telling stories. And it's hard for a lot of these women because they were stories that were intentionally marginalized, intentionally paved over, sometimes by their allies, by white communists, sometimes by white dominated press, sometimes by the liberal Black press. And so I try to tell as much of those stories as I can. And so for Detroit, the woman who really exemplifies it is Rose Billups. Rose Billups is the wife of Joseph Billups, who is a Black auto worker. And so we're talking Detroit, 1930s, we're talking automobile industry reigns supreme. Ford, obviously, Henry Ford is one of the icons, but just the entire city is under the thumb of the auto industry. And so Rose's husband, Joseph, works in the automobile industry, but he's also getting involved in this radical politics. White communists are coming and saying, hey, join our forces. We can do something to fight, to organize in this time and place of the Great Depression in Detroit. And Detroit had always had some organizing in automobile industries, but never really included Black workers. So when Black workers get involved in organizing the automobile industries, this is radicalism turned up to a next level. But where does that leave the women? Black women in Detroit are not going to be employed in this heavy industry. The numbers are like less than hundreds, whereas tens of thousands of Black men are. But that doesn't mean they weren't involved, right? That doesn't mean they didn't have anything at stake. Rose watched as her husband, Joseph, tried to get a job and then was immediately fired. He got another job, was immediately fired. His radical activism was too much of a threat to these employers. And so she's the one who's holding a job as a hat maker in the city. She's the one who is supporting him. She's the one, when they have rallies in parks in the center of town, she's the one who's collecting bones and meat and beans from anybody in the neighborhood. She's the one throwing them in a pot and serving these workers who are on strike and can't afford to feed themselves. And just a fun little story, Joseph later said that her cooking wasn't that good, but, you know, it filled these workers up. And I just like, really, Joseph, you got thrown under the bus like that. But again, because Rose wasn't in those factories on those lines building the cars, she had something so much at stake at this. Another example, she raised money for the Working Woman, a magazine that addressed the particular issues of women in the Communist Party. And once the automobile unions kind of got going towards the end of the 30s, we see women like Rose become even bigger players in organizing factories, specifically Ford here. And if you think about it, Black workers are always going to it's been the historical truth that, or unfortunate truth, that for most of American history up to this point, Black workers were not recruited into labor unions because they were, again, for historical reasons, used as strike breakers. And so when communists come in, and then eventually we'll see the AUW, auto workers. Okay, the Auto Workers Union was the communists, and then the UAW, United Auto Workers, was the CIO, the more centered mainstream labor organization. So when they finally come in, they're trying to get these Black workers. Okay, so they're trying to get these Black workers in the factories to join their union. These Black workers are like, I don't know. We haven't had a great history. We're not sure about this. How do you get Black workers, these Black men, to join the unions? You get their wives. And so Rose Billups is meeting with the auto workers' wives in dark alleys. She's like hiding pamphlets. She's going door to door. She is organizing to such an extent that she is, you know, an auto worker organizer, even though she wasn't employed in the factories. And I think the most remarkable thing about Rose is her husband was really well known. Joseph Billups, if you go to Wayne State University archives there, he's like, you can get a ton of information on him. And there's this one interview with him and his wife. And the interviewer is like, Joseph, tell me about this. Tell me about this. Tell me about this. And at one point, Rose, and this is in like the 70s. At one point, Rose says like, excuse me, can I take a minute to tell you about how the women helped organize this union? And that's just so indicative, right, of Black women in this struggle. Just because they weren't there on the factory lines, then their stories aren't as important. And really, that's what my work and project here says, is their stories are so, so important for truly understanding labor history in the United States.
Yeah, and you talk about sort of the Ford Motor Company, and if we're talking about Detroit, it looms very, very large upon this period of time in the entire history of Detroit, right? One of the events that you highlight in this chapter is the Ford Hunger March. So I wonder if you could just tell us a little bit about that, sort of its aftermath, and also sort of how Black women were involved in that event as well.
Right. So the Ford Hunger March was organized in 1931 to highlight the poor wages for Ford factory workers. And Ford, first of all, no relation. Just got to get that out there. I don't think I am, at least. So Ford had cut wages repeatedly for the Great Depression, even though he's saying, oh, we're fine, the business is fine, his workers are making pennies, right? And so with the local radical activists, parts of the unemployed councils, parts of the AWU, even the Socialist Party was there for a bit, came together and said, hey, we're going to have this massive meeting, massive protest, and march onto one of the Ford factories to show we're all in this together. You know, it's classic grassroots activism. They do so, and it's one of those moments in history. We don't know who cast the first stone, but protesters said that the cops fired first. The law enforcement said that the protesters were throwing rocks. Ultimately, law enforcement opens fire at four workers. Protesters, marchers are instantly killed. Another dies a few days later. A black man dies a few days later from his injuries. And so this confirms everything for black workers. Henry Ford is the worst. He's the devil. They have signs that say, we wanted food, Ford gave us bullets. And so he's incredibly vilified. And it's really a moment of picking up steam for labor movement in Detroit. And that story has been told. People have written those books. Less told is a story of Mattie Woodson. And so here's another story where I get to tell about an extraordinary woman. Mattie Woodson was a black woman, migrant, a southern migrant to Detroit, who was not working in the factories. You know, she wasn't this laborer, but she had a huge stake in the success of black men and their black working class in Detroit. So she had joined the Communist Party. She was there at the march on the front lines. And when the officers opened fire, Mattie went to go tend to the wound of a white communist who had fallen. She tore off a piece of her skirt and used it to stop the bleeding in this incredible moment of interracial class solidarity. And apparently, now this all comes from an interview that was conducted a few years ago from another black protester at the Hunger March. And so, I mean, it's, yes, you know, a few years in hindsight. But this moment where David Moore is the man who's giving this interview, he says this moment of a black woman who is bending down and stopping the bleeding of a white communist and white comrade is just so amazing. And then the Ford Motor Company took a photo of it, the local press took a photo of it, but then Henry Ford squashed it and no one ever saw the photograph. And that was the end of the story. And so honestly, I went to Detroit archives looking for that photograph, but it doesn't exist. But that story exists, that Mattie Woodson would go risk her life to be a part of this struggle. And she continued to. She continued to host communist meetings in her household. In the 1950s, she was named in the Red Scare and the congressional hearings. She kind of falls off the radar. It's hard to tell what happened to some of these women because they have this brief moment. And then a historian, you're kind of grasping at straws. But so women like Mattie Woodson, definitely a part of the Communist Party, risking her life there. Women like Rose Billups, wife of a black steel, black auto worker, supporter, cook, also there. And so that really plays into a lot of the stories of these women in the Midwest, is there's not one story. They all have their beautiful, unique, tragic stories. And I try as best as possible to recreate and to amplify those stories and their voices, but historians of marginalized communities will know it's very hard.
And so in chapter two, you take us to your backyard, to St. Louis. I wonder if you could just talk to us about another event that you narrate there, the Funstein strike. And I wonder if you could also talk about the role of the Communist Party and sort of the aftermath of that strike as well.
Yeah. Oh boy, St. Louis. And so first enter with this knowing that it's really crazy to write about your own backyard. It's interesting and also very disturbing to know that history. But Kiana Urban actually brought this to my attention with her work and the Funston strike. And I sought to look at this moment, 1933 strike, where over 1,000 women, 1,000 black women struck from this series of factories in St. Louis and actually won their demands. I tried to ask that question, well, what else is happening in St. Louis and these other cities that makes this possible? And so Funston Nut Factory. Let's tell a story. Carrie Smith. Carrie Smith is 43. Oh, I forget her age, but she's a middle-aged Black woman who's a migrant from Mississippi. She's been working at the same factory for over 10 years, and it's called the Funston Nut Factory, and she is employed as a nut picker. So basically, pecans come in from the south. They're shipped up the Mississippi River. Pecans in their shells come in, and women like Carrie Smith sit at these long tables and crack the nuts for hours and hours a day, just taking out the nut meat and then separate it from the nut shells. And it's these long tables, it's low lighting, it's freezing in the winter, it's stifling in the summer. The nuts themselves emit this like particles in the air, so everyone's always choking. It's miserable. And so once the Great Depression hits, of course the wages for these Black women are slashed again and again and again. And so it's at this point when we see White Communist Party in St. Louis pick up steam. And there's some facts lost to history here. How does it really start? But at the end of the beginning of the story is we have White Communists sponsoring a meeting saying, hey, women who work at the Funston Nut Factory, come join us and we will help you strike. And so Carrie Smith is there. She is like, I am all in it. And I just can't imagine this moment. She's a middle-aged Black woman. She goes to church every day. She's a migrant from Mississippi. I have a picture of her in the book, and she just is not what you think as a radical communist. And that's why I love it so much, because she's like, guys, I'm here. I'm showing up. And in the most inspiring part of the book, and where my title comes from, she's leading a demonstration at City Hall. The Funston Nut Pickers, as they're known, had been striking for about a week or so, and they're kind of losing steam. And so Carrie Smith is on the steps of City Hall. She's trying to get them rallied. She's saying, you know, girls, we got to stick together. We can do this. I know it's hard. And the story goes, she has a Bible in one hand and a brick in the other. And she says, girls, we cannot lose. And so this imagery of this woman with a book, with a brick and a Bible, just, it really captured me. I was like, I have to use this, because it really symbolizes what these women during this time were about. They were about that brick. I mean, literally, sometimes they had to use bricks to defend themselves. They were militant in their operations. They were unceasing in their actions, but also the Bible. Literally and metaphorically, Carrie Smith was a church-going woman. She brought the Bible every day to those picket lines. She led people in prayer and hymns. And so you have this militancy, and you have this religious woman, and you have it, and they're not in competition. It's a conversation for Carrie Smith and for many of the Funston Nut Pickers, and then many of the women in the other cities as well. And so the Communist Party, this is in St. Louis especially, was, I don't want to say this, but they were kind of, well, I'll say it, they were racist. They didn't think Black workers in St. Louis could be organized. And before 1930, there are no Blacks in the Communist Party in St. Louis. In fact, they got a good deal on a house to rent as their party headquarters, but they didn't want to rent it because it was in a Black neighborhood, and they thought property values would depreciate. After the Funston strike, after they won their demands, after there was an amazing show of interracial solidarity, and these Black women came out amazing, and Carrie Smith is, you know, badass with a brick and a Bible, the Communist Party, I mean, they're selling chitlins on the street because they're like, oh, Black workers, look, we're here for you, we're supporting you. And it's like, and that's often the story, is the Communist Party not manipulated, the Communist Party used the actions of these women for their own, for the party's own gain. And that's an argument, again, I'm not the first to make. That's quite often been the historical truth, is that these Black workers were pawns, if you will, in the Communist Party hands. And that's only part of the story, though. Because as we see with Carrie Smith and, you know, Rose Phillips and Mattie Whitson and all these other women, they are not pawns. They're not puppets. They're not jumping because Stalin says how high, right? They are interpreting their unique circumstances and their unique lived experiences to inform their activism. And now Irvine Painter says it best when she says that communists, Black communists during this time made the party their own. And so then my kind of addition to that is Midwestern Black radicalism was a part of making their party their own. Because Carrie Smith, again, fades from the records. Did she remain a communist? I don't know. Did the Communist Party defend her or, you know, support her? Or I don't know. But she has this brief moment where she's on the steps of City Hall with a brick and a Bible. And just, I love that.
And you, so in chapter three, you take us to Chicago, which has a long history of sort of radical organizing. And you say that Midwestern Black radicalism manifested differently in this city than the other cities that you're studying in this project. I wonder if you could sort of explain that a little bit.
Right. So got to give a shout out to, I'm just going to name all the historians I've built on because there's so much work that has been done and I'm building on that. So Randy Storch wrote Red Chicago, which is about radicalism in Chicago. And she does make mention of Black communists. And the first thing that's different about Chicago is it was ready to go for radical organizing. I mean, this is the birth of the 8-hour workday. This is the Haymarket riot place. This is just a real hotbed of radical activity. And then when you couple into that, the UNIA had a particularly active branch there. You have a Black working class being very politically minded and agitated and ready to go. And so when the communists begin specifically targeting Black neighborhoods, the unemployed councils start reaching out to workers. Chicagoans, Black Chicagoans in particular, are ready to respond. And yeah, so that makes Chicago very different. In St. Louis, you didn't have that presence before 1930. But by 1930 in Chicago, it was there, it was ready, it was ripe for the action.
Yeah, and some of this also sort of comes up in some campaigns that have sort of shortcomings as well, right? So you talk about the Don't Buy campaign that happened. I wonder if you could talk about that and some of the shortcomings that you see with that project.
Right. And so that's one part of why Chicago was so, you know, ready to radicalize was because Black Chicago, you know, what they call Bronzeville or the Black Belt, were not unified, but had undergone their own sort of renaissance in the 1920s and had their Black newspapers, their Black banks. You had the Black sports teams and all this kind of legacy that had been building. And part of that was these newspapers, specifically the Chicago Whip, which in 1929, kind of on the eve of the Great Depression, was saying, hey, we are a Black community that holds power. We should do something with this power. And Black workers can't get jobs at certain hotels or restaurants or banks or other industries. And so the Chicago Whip says, hey, don't buy where you can't work. And that becomes a don't buy campaign. And they're not the first to do this. This is a boycott, right? But it's a very particular iteration on the eve and then beginning of the Great Depression. And it was successful, right? Hard to completely measure the success of the boycott, but many Black workers did get employed in these, you know, middle-class jobs, which is incredible, which is a huge success. And the movement, the Don't Buy campaign, went on for several years. But when you're talking about the early Great Depression and you're talking about Black banks were the first to fail, Black workers are the first to be laid off. Unemployment for Black workers is significantly double, if not triple in some states, higher for Black workers. That those few jobs weren't enough. And the Don't Buy campaign relied on Black consumerism, on their purchasing power. And at the end of the day, capitalism working its way. And so in light of such economic devastation, many African-American workers then in Chicago are looking beyond that sort of more conservative approach. And so again, when the communists come in and say, hey, we're going to strike, we're going to stick it to the man, we're going to protest outside of Black politicians' homes, we're going to feed you, we're going to do all these you know, bread and butter issues as well as take down capitalism, they were had a receptive audience.
And so you have two events, I feel like, that are sort of pivotal in this chapter too. So you have the Chicago Massacre, and then also the strike that happens at the Sopkin factories. And I wonder if you could talk about those two and how they sort of play a role in this study.
Yeah, so the Chicago Massacre, as you say, was a riot in August of 1931. And these riots rule... So it's the Great Depression. Black families can't get work. They can't pay their rent. And they're commonly evicted. It happens in Cleveland, too, in particular. There are like 3,000 evictions a year. And it's just insane. And so there's one particular eviction going on in Chicago. And it's a Black woman who is, you know, trying to make her way. And rumor goes around the neighborhood that she's being harassed by white law enforcement. So people gather. People are ready. They're agitated. Somebody throws a rock. Somebody fires a shot. And at the end of the day, we have several of the protesters killed. And this becomes a huge rallying cry, just like the Ford Hunger March. A community rallies behind it. This is another important marker for Black workers' activism, but also for their education, knowing that, hey, if we come together, white dominated society is scared and they will react with violence. But there's power in numbers. And the Communist Party was consistently there to remind them of that. And so we do have a lot of Chicago workers, Black Chicago workers, join the Communist Party after this incident, saying that, hey, communists are the only ones looking out for us. We're here. We're there for them. And with that, then, you have another story similar to St. Louis. We have Black women working in horrible working conditions in the Sopkin factories, which make house aprons. And someone in the Communist Party, a Black communist, comes to the Sopkin women and saying, hey, you saw what we did in St. Louis. We can help you get a union in Chicago. And so this happens literally a month after the organizing in St. Louis. And so this is why I argue there's a Midwestern Black radicalism. There are themes going on here. There's currents. There's after effects. It's all building on each other in this region. And so Sopkin factories, it's a brutal, brutal strike. These women are attacked on the street by police and strikebreakers. They are, you know, devastated in terms of their living conditions and any sort of welfare they can get. It's a very hard fought victory. And eventually they do win their demands and showing that there is room for Black radicalism. And I think the important thing here is they're organizing as garment workers in the spring of 1933. At the end of 1933, the whole country will go on this huge garment worker strikes led by the International Ladies Garment Workers Union, which was the mainstream union. So we're seeing here Black women not only be like the first, but like they're the harbingers, right? They're doing it and being successful at it before mainstream unions even thought about it. So Sopkin, the Chicago Massacre, both incredibly important events that... help radicalize the Black community to these points of really important success.
And so your last study takes us to Cleveland, where you say that Black people experience race differently from Black people in the other cities in this study. And so I wonder if you could talk about sort of why and how that is.
Yeah, so Cleveland was not originally on my project or on my list. It's because no one thinks about Cleveland. And I'm sorry. I love Cleveland. My visits there have been great. But I was, you know, so focused on this kind of more central Midwest and those cities that were known for their radicalism. And Cleveland, as it turns out, had both radical and not so radical tendencies. The established Black middle upper class in Cleveland was really pretty conservative and pretty middling and liberal on the eve of the Great Depression. But with the newcomers, the Southern migrants during the Great Migration, we saw that dynamic change. And we'll see that Cleveland's past as a radical city really come to light. And so, like, Cleveland itself was a point for white radicalism, specifically farmers and light and heavy organized industrial organizing. And so when we have this influx of black workers from the South saying, hey, that liberal attitude of accepting, you know, capitalism in these conditions isn't going to work anymore. Hey, that white attitude of only white workers should be organized, that's not going to work anymore. You have this huge moment of possibility. And that's why the chapter for Cleveland is revolution and reform, because you got both.
And you have a number of black women that you talk about in this chapter also that sort of engaged in activism and also politics. I wonder if you could highlight a few of those and tell just a little bit of their stories.
Oh, yeah. Oh, just so many wonderful stories here. Mary Tabb, let's talk about her. She was out of work woman during this time. She lived in a highly industrialized area, a black neighborhood that was, you know, didn't get the funds necessary and, you know, just a rundown neighborhood. One day, the unemployed council, so these radical organizers, literally came through her neighborhood and signed her up, saying like, hey, do you want to do something about your situation? And she's like, damn right I do. This is bullshit. And so she joins the unemployed councils. She marches with them to City Hall. There's this line in one of the communist publications where she's marching in a downpour of freezing rain and sleet. She has thin clothing on and her shoes are torn. Just this real kind of tragic vision of her, but she pursues it nonetheless, and she marches to City Hall and makes her name known. Not only that, she's chosen as a delegate to meet with the mayor at the time. And so she goes up to him and directly says, we will not starve peacefully. And she's totally confrontational in her approach. She talks about how her little boy is starving while the mayor's kids goes to college. And so she's super upfront and really, you know, no bars held, which is such an amazing moment. But she continues to participate with the Communist Party. She's chosen to speak in Washington, D.C. It's a real moment how of the story of going from a black worker who is disempowered to a point of having her story heard by the mayor of the city. And a lot of it, and it's due to her persistence. It's due to that legacy of black radical tradition that she is drawing from, but also legacy of black women's activism as well. And so when the Communist Party, you know, literally comes to her door, they're not making something new. They're not telling her nothing she's heard before. She's like, yeah, okay, I'm ready. Let's do it. And that's kind of the story of Cleveland. There's this one great quote from a newspaper that was commenting on black workers who got involved in the Cleveland Communist Party, saying that the black workers, quote, may have never heard of Karl Marx and know little of Russia, but they do know when they're hungry and cold, when they are pushed out of even low wage employment and finally evicted from the dwellings which their neighbors, white neighbors, spurned long ago. And so, yeah, maybe Marx isn't on their bookshelf, but they know suffering. They know capitalist exploitation, and they're ready to fight.
And in your conclusion, you make what I think is a very interesting argument about sort of historical continuity of this moment, right? So you sort of connect the actions of these women in the 1930s to the Black Lives Matter movement. And I wonder if you could just articulate that for people listening.
Right. And this goes back to this whole idea of the black radical tradition. As Cedric Robinson claims, it has its ups and downs, right? Its continuities and its disruptures. But every generation, he says, you know, uses the experiences of previous generation to inform theirs and the future. I'll just quote him because he says it much better, of course. Quote, each generation assembles the data of his experiences to an ideology of liberation. And so the Black radical tradition is continually evolving and continually changing, but it does draw that momentum, that influence, that foundation from the past. So when you're thinking about Black Lives Matter, you have signs like defund the police. That's drawing from, you know, the Ford hunger massacre when they had signs that said, we want food, not bullets. Or if you think about the police violence that the Sopkin women faced when they're striking on the streets, that's exactly the same thing about police brutality. There's numerous stories about how Black workers couldn't get health care after they're injured on the job, and life expectancy in Black neighborhoods was so much less in the 1930s. Well, guess what? In the age of COVID, guess what communities are suffering long-term health effects and deaths more? It's Black communities again. And so it's that repeat of these familiar stories, the minimum wage, unemployment benefits, all these things. But the new generation, Black Lives Matter, is obviously adding something different. We're adding that element of LGBTQ. We're adding that element of technology, social media to promote these issues. And we're seeing it as a real point of the radical tradition kind of softening and finding a way to reach out to white liberals. Because the rebellion of 2020 is what historians call Black Lives Matter movement in 2020, broke records for Americans protesting, right? And it was estimated that, you know, 15 to 24 million Americans had protested against police brutality. That doesn't happen in 1930s, because the 1930s are very rigid with their ideology and interpretation of Black radicalism. But the Black radicalism now has transitioned to that a more palatable phase. That said, there are absolutely still those ardent Black radicalists who are saying defund the police and white capitalism is antithetical to Black existence. And those are amazing voices that continue to be heard, because it's those radical voices that push the white-dominated mainstream a little bit more towards racial, social justice. Ideally, at least, the saying goes that the radicals make the centrists look better, and hopefully the centrists will tend left. And that's honestly, that's the dream, right? That's the ideals, not the lived reality.
And so I wonder if there's one takeaway that you would want readers to have after reading your book.
The Midwest is not a flyover zone. It's not a place where nothing happens. When I was working on my dissertation during the Ferguson uprising, and all this national news was like, what? How could this happen in Missouri? What's going on in Missouri? What's going on in the American heartland? And I'm like, damn it, aren't you paying attention? This has been going on since the 1930s and even before that. And so my takeaway is that this is not new. This is an unfortunate continuity. They're, yes, different players, different events, different posters and placards, but we're essentially repeating these same arguments. And as a historian, it's so, so, so frustrating. And as a human being, even more so. So Black history matters. Black Midwest matters. And if we ignore those histories, if we ban people from reading those books or talking about it in classrooms, not only are we doomed to repeat it, we are doomed to fail as a society.
Well, Dr. Melissa Ford, we've taken up a lot of your time, and thank you so much for being so gracious with that. So I'll ask one final question. What are you working on now?
Well, I have now fallen in love with local histories. And so I'm currently located in Pittsburgh. And Pittsburgh is this another great city that has yet to really become a mainstream place of study for Black history. So I want to look at Black history in in Pittsburgh, and look at the Black women who were a part of this struggle. I mean, Pittsburgh is known as the Steel City. Let's look at those wives of those steel workers, because my research in the other cities had shown that they're essential parts of that movement.
yeah, that sounds like a really great project, honestly.
And it's also really easy when you live in the town where the archives are. So for grad students out there, it's okay to look local.
Indeed, it definitely is. So Dr. Melissa Ford, I want to thank you for being on the show today. I really enjoyed listening from you and the conversation, and take care.
Oh, thank you so much. It was my pleasure.